You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Welcome back to another episode of Talk the Walk. Today I'm joined by Doug Dunlop, a senior counsellor with Relationships Australia. Among many other things, Doug is a practitioner and coordinator of Holding Children Together, a trauma-informed outreach service working therapeutically with mostly Aboriginal kids and their families in Alice Springs and surrounding town camps. As well as counselling and psychotherapy, Doug's long list of skills include program management, clinical supervision, evaluation, group work, developing policy, and facilitating educational and training workshops. Doug arrived in Australia in 2011 from New Zealand, taking up residence in the Northern Territory and has never looked back. There's obviously something about this place that has gotten under his skin, as it does with so many of us that find their way here. Hopefully we'll discover some of these secrets today. So thank you for joining me, Doug.
You're welcome, Lucy.
So tell us, what was it about Australia and the NT in particular that attracted you here?
I suppose the result of us arriving in Alice Springs really was that my mother had been ill for a long time and passed away in 2010. And I said to my wife, well, do you want to travel now or do you want to wait till we're in Walkers? And she said, now. I applied through an agency for a job and was offered a job at Alice, and here I still am.
So coming from New Zealand, what were the most important considerations for you, I guess, starting to work with Aboriginal communities in Australia?
I think the thing was that I was eased into it. I mean, early on, following my arrival, I was invited into the community therapeutic team, which was a group of practitioners who were working with children in Alice. And at the time, I was a victims of crime counsellor with Anglicare. And so I was eased into this type of work through that. But it also comes from, I suppose, a history of training and running with my wife, who's Māori, and Noho Marais, which was a compulsory social work training course in, if you like, tikanga and Māori that everyone doing social work degree had to do in New Zealand. So I had some cross-cultural experience, but it's similar but very different. There's much more poverty and much more marginalisation in the Aboriginal community than in the Māori community. And at one level, it was horrific to be exposed to that experience. And I suppose the reality for me was that every one of the kids is worth whatever it costs to help them and support them to have a better life.
And can you explain a little bit more about what you see as the similarities and differences between Indigenous peoples of New Zealand and Indigenous peoples of Australia?
The similarities are the value of culture and the value of family and the spiritual sense that they hold in terms of the land. I think those are very similar. I think the difference between Māori have a tribal custom as against Aboriginal having a family custom. So their lives are centred around family, whereas Māori tend to be more centred around their tribal ancestry.
And so are there some obvious differences in how you practice and work in Australia compared to what you would have been doing back in New Zealand?
Without any question. In some ways, I would say that in the way in which I therapeutically practice here, in some areas of the profession in New Zealand, they would see as not a way to practice. I mean, one example would be that we do a lot of activities with kids. You know, I play tennis with boys, I play basketball with boys, I play cards with boys, whereas I hadn't perceived that as being appropriate work prior to coming here. You know, I remember the first client I had in this program, a young boy of 11 who had an absolute lack of empathy, and he couldn't see the world from anywhere else. And we probably played basketball for a period of about 3 months, and we played tennis as well. And one day playing basketball, he said to me, "Are you all right, old man?" and my heart just lifted because he had got a sense of empathy. And for me, it was like, I don't care how I get there, I've got there.
So these activities that you talk about are really about developing relationships.
Trusting, healing relationships where I am consistent, where we get engaged in something and can talk over the top of that. And somehow it releases, gives the child more freedom to speak. You know, I can give lots of examples of kids who are really silent, you know, and then you sit down and play Uno with them. And over the top of the card game, you hear lots of their story and can meet them in their story and help them shift their story a bit.
Right. So these ways of engaging with kids, how would you have been doing that back in New Zealand? What sort of ways are you developing that relationship?
In New Zealand, I always worked in a counselling room. In Australia, I work on a, you know, throwing a ball around on a basketball court or on a tennis court, going for walks with clients, sitting in McDonald's sometimes. In New Zealand, I did some lovely work with children, but it wasn't my focus, but always had blocks and stuff in my counselling room so that for younger children who'd come along with the adult. And I'm reminded of one particular episode that really moved me. And I was working with a grandfather who was the president of a gang. And he came into session and he had his two-year-old grandchild with him. And he said, I hope it's all right that I brought my boy. And I said, yeah, it's fine. And so I got the blocks out. And this two-year-old child had never seen blocks, but almost instinctively knew what to do with them. Mm. And I sat down on the floor and helped him stack the blocks. And then grandfather got down and started playing with blocks as well. And grandfather started crying. And he said, I've never played with blocks. And this is a man in his late 50s.
Yeah, wow. Tell us about Holding Children Together. It's a program that's built on a trauma-informed kind of model developed in conjunction with the Australian Childhood Foundation. Trauma-informed practice is the buzzword being talked about in social work and other allied health fields at the moment. What's your understanding of trauma-informed practice, and what does it look like on the ground when you're working with Aboriginal children and their families?
Well, I think firstly, understanding what the child's experience might have been and the resulting needs that weren't met from the horror of the trauma that they've experienced is how I see a trauma-informed lens. And the way in which we work it is that it's needs-based, and so we don't see the behaviours as the problem. We see the lack of unmet needs or the unmet needs or lack of needs to be met as the problem. And so, and our experience is that when we can get others in our community and in our care teams to hold the children's needs as the focus and understand the behaviours about unmet needs, we get a total a shift in the way that child's seen. We get a shift to a place of compassion and sorrow and understanding rather than the child being naughty.
So you mentioned the care team. Can you tell us a bit about the care team model, which I know is an integrative part of the therapeutic intervention that you're doing? What are the values, I guess, or principles underpinning the care team model?
It's the model that we developed in 2013, and it's operated in other places. But the program here had started in 2011 as a children's counselling service. And very quickly, we saw that an issue addressed the environmental impacts that have caused the dysfunction for the child or the trauma for the child and create more safety. There's only a certain amount of relief the child's going to get from the trauma. And so the care team model was introduced. And basically it is, once we assess what the children's needs are, who is it that needs to be involved to support those needs being met? And so it may be an intensive family support service. It's often territory families. It's always the school. It's always the carer. And with children in care, it's often the parent as well. So all those people can contribute to a better experience of well-being for the child and having the child's needs become the focus of the group rather than the child's bad behaviour, which is trauma-based behaviour, being the focus of the work.
Can you give us a bit of an idea on, I guess, what a typical day might look like for you as a counsellor working in this way with the children and families that are part of your caseload?
As the programs evolved, I do less on the groundwork and a bit more management. But if you look at we have a team of five counsellors, and a typical intervention each week with a child would be that we would spend an hour with the child in direct engagement, relationship building, and building safety and trust. And we probably spend about 3 hours working through other services, liaising with church families, liaising with the school, looking at particular issues. And we try and have a care team meeting at least monthly, but when a child's experiencing transition and change, like care changing or schools changing or some change, we would bring those care teams. Some care team meetings meet weekly. But on average, we say it's about 4 hours per client per week that's needed to do this function.
So I mentioned before that the majority of the children that you're working with are Aboriginal. What percentage would you say you're working with that is Aboriginal?
At the moment, it would be about 92%.
And what protocols did you have in place to ensure that, I guess, holding children together was developed and implemented in a culturally safe way?
Well, in the early days, we started off with a cultural advisory group. They inputted into how the program should work. They inputted into providing us with a worker from that group who worked with us 2 days a week, particularly doing family work. In other words, introducing us to start building the relationship with family. Okay, and then we employed a young Aboriginal man who's Walpuri, who has a lovely relationship with the kids and also lots of family connection in Dallas. So in a sense, it helped us to walk the bridge between the cultures.
And that's kind of an ongoing thing within the program, that the Aboriginal workers are working alongside the counsellors?
As much as we can do it with five counsellors and one part-time Aboriginal worker. But we do have two other cultural advisors in RA, where I'm located, and we have another cultural advisor who's part of the Royal Commission, who are available to us from time to time to meet those needs. The reality is that, you know, after about 3 months, we have a reasonable relationship with most of the carers and parents to the degree that it's safe for us to be there. I mean, one of the things culturally is that I, as a male, never visit a female Aboriginal person by myself because of the nature of Alice, if you like, but also because of the nature of what's culturally appropriate. It's not appropriate for me as a male to do that unless I have permission from the person. And I suppose in the bundle of kids I've held, there's probably three or four women in their 40s who found it quite fine for me to be there on my own. But apart from that, I've always had a female with me.
And I know that you've been steering a quite rigorous evaluation process with a view to holding children together becoming the first evidence-based counselling program of its kind. Can you tell us about some of the challenges of developing an evidence-based program that's culturally appropriate?
It's been a challenge. The way in which we did it is we consulted with the cultural advisory group, and we also consulted with the Australian Childhood Foundation and the community therapeutic team. And at the time, the community therapeutic team had 18 counsellors, all from different organisations in Alice Springs, all who had, there was some Indigenous workers in that as well. And we said, what is it we do? Okay, and we came up with four working groups out of that 18 who sat down and took the feedback from the big group of what we do and went away and played with it. And we came back and said, well, the first thing is safety. In terms of developing it, safety became the priority. And then the next thing was, okay, what's part of the work we do for kids? We want kids to be able to engage in school, to be able to engage in learning, and to stay on task. So that became, in a sense, our second measurement. So if we are being successful in our work and in the care team, those things will improve for the children. And then we thought, with traumatized children, there's two things that are often really difficult for them. And one is relationship, and the other thing is the ability to connect with people and manage transitions. So we came up with two other sort of schemas, and one was the ability to engage relationship, and we had some sub-criteria in there, and the other one was the ability to manage transition and change, okay? Mm-hmm. Because those are the difficulties that traumatized kids have, and therefore, if those things are improving, the trauma is reducing, and the trauma behaviors are reducing as well.
So what difference did it make looking at those four areas, having a cultural lens?
I suppose the definition was that those had to be measures that the community in itself accepted. And when we, we talk about a three-month process to get to those measures, and then putting it back in front of the representative from the culture advisory group, really giving some space to the cultural workers who were in the community therapeutic team and seeing if that's how they felt, that they were appropriate measures for what they wanted for their children. And basically, we didn't have any disagreement in that.
So you said at the beginning that it was challenging. What were the most challenging pieces of being able to develop, and I know that you're still working on it, an evidence-based program?
Quality data capture is a real challenge. You know, the way in which we capture data is we take data at 1 month after referral. So in other words, we say, okay, so we've done an assessment, and this is the trauma experience of the child, and these are the measures against all our assessment criteria. Right, so we get a baseline at the entry point, or after we've done most of the entry point. The next one is done about 6 months after that. And what happens is that we get the teachers to do it. We get the parent and the carer, or just the carer, or just the parent, depending on who's involved. We ask the department to do one if they're involved. We ask any other service that's involved to do one. And where there's special needs teachers, we often get them to do one as well as the teacher. So we get about five or six, and we say it's a minimum of three or four for each child. And they all score it on a sort of 1 to 5 basis across different measures, depending on what the area is. And one of our problems in the early stages was, well, I don't know what the relationship of this child is with the parent from a teacher. And our response basically is, well, why don't you? So we had quite a bit of to and froing with getting quality data. And because teachers change and things, that seems to be a bit of an ongoing problem. And trying to say, okay, we need at least three or four surveys for every child every 6 months. And I know you're busy staff, but that's what we need to do, because we need to show that we're worth funding. And we need to show if this is working for our kids, other kids deserve it as well.
I know that you've been working in the project, what is it, 5 years now?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us about, I guess, some of the success stories or the sparkling moments, as I like to call them, things that stand out to you, making a real difference to kids' lives there in Alice Springs?
Well, I spoke before about that 11-year-old boy I'd done some basketball with. And in January this year, I was standing in Coles, and I got this great big hug from behind. And I hadn't seen this boy for about 3 years. And I turned around, and this beaming young man was there, and he'd give me a cuddle. And it was like the fact that he seemed overjoyed to see me after about 3 years was wonderful. But then we had a discussion, and he, you know, at 11, he wasn't engaged in school and had just started re-engaging. And at, nearly 16, he's in year 11. And so it's like, I don't know what happened, but we did the best we could, and somehow it worked.
Really? You don't know what happened? I'm sure you've got some clues about what did work in that situation.
Yeah, well, in the care team, it's hard to differentiate who's contributed the most. Whether my, 25 hours with mum enabled her to give a different experience to the child, whether the teacher's understanding this child's needs enabled him to have a different experience in school. At one level, we can say it's all of it. but that care team model doesn't make it precious for any one of us to take responsibility for the change. It's a shared gift.
I guess that's the beauty of the care team model, isn't it? When you've got this whole network around that child and meeting the needs of the child and being aware of what those needs are. And then that makes it difficult, like you say, in your evaluation processes to work out, well, what actually worked here? You can't pinpoint it to one actual thing because it's many things.
Yeah, and it may be the care teams are measuring and not the kids, if you like, at one level. The care teams were a real challenge to introduce, and when new people come in, they're still a real challenge. We have rooms in 7 schools in Alice where we see the children, and a new teacher coming in, and we'll get new teachers in January, and they're used to environments where the focus is on the behavioural issues, where our environment is moving towards more the needs base, and the struggle to get them to understand is part of the hard work. Our assessments and therapeutic plans that we write are focused on the needs, which helps them to get over the behaviour, but it takes a bit of time. I remember the early days, we had one principal who, when we talk about needs, was really on the page, and then we'd go into the next meeting and she'd start talking about behaviours. We'd sort of shift it back to needs, and all of a sudden there was a huge shift in compassion in the whole room. And we do things like when we go to a care team meeting, we put the child's picture on the middle of the table. So, you know, this is a child-focused thing. And we've also had challenges working with family support agencies where they see the focus as being about on the family. And we say our focus is on the kids' needs. And yes, support is needed for the family to support this child's change, but it also will support the parents changing as well. And I suppose the magical ones are the reunifications when a child goes back to mum from being in the out-of-home care. That's the ones that probably move all of us the most. And they're probably the hardest piece of work that we do in terms of there's so much criticism of children that are uplifted. And a lot of it's not valid, in my view. You know, and when I first started here, there was a lot of talk about this mother's not even visiting her kids. And, you know, when you inquire a bit further, it's like, okay, so the kids were uplifted 2 months ago. I wonder what it's been like for mum not to have her kids. And my surprise was that people hadn't thought of that. Territory families don't give any support to mum once the kids go. And that's not good enough, in my view, because I can imagine if my children had been uplifted, the grief and loss and the horror and the shame would be almost unbearable. And that is what we are able to do now through this care team model, in terms of, you know, if kids are uplifted, we can give mum some support. We can encourage mum to have a visitation with her children and support her. And there's one reunification we've done that mum for 2 years didn't have any wish to have her children back. And one day she came to us and said, I want my children back. And that's a wonderful experience. And in part it says she's healed, but another part is I'm taking responsibility for doing this. And, you know, our response initially was, well, you know what you have to do. And she said, yeah, I know what I have to do. And she did it.
So would you say that the care team model creates a more successful or effective way of helping reunification happen?
Yes, I would. I think the first thing, it gets all those involved with that child and family on the same page. And the page is the child's need. So the child is at the focus and at the centre of the intervention, okay? And in doing that, we can share stuff like, how was it for mum when the kids were uplifted? And maybe that's why she hasn't been able to visit, because it's too painful. You know, so we can build the reality out to be more inclusive and less judgmental. And that therefore changes the relationships that territory families will have with the parent. It changes the relationships with the school, and that's terribly important for the children. Reunifications are really complex, because often we've done a huge amount of work with the out-of-home care organisation to get them to support the child's recovery needs from trauma, and to understand that the child needs connection and presence rather than someone there to cook their meals. And so a lot of the carers have developed quite close attachments to the children that they have in their care. And so the separation of them going back to mum puts up all that judgment about mum wasn't good enough before, what's changed that she's good enough now, you know, those sorts of things. And even carers have been known to make fictitious reports about mum when reunification is on the ground. Yeah. There's no easy way around anything. It's just relational.
So I know that you're incredibly passionate about the work that you're doing there in Alice Springs. What is it that, I guess, keeps you there, inspires you or drives you to continue to do this work for children and families there?
Well, some of it's about my own personal journey. My oldest child's 42. My youngest child, who's whangai in terms of Māori adoption, is 17. And there's a convoluted a range of children between, some stepchildren and some step-stepchildren. And if I look at the way I was a dad to my 42-year-old and the way I was a dad to my 17-year-old, my 42-year-old didn't get enough of me, and she deserved more, and maybe I'm contributing there. And the other thing is that kids deserve the best, and society has the responsibility to address that and to give families who don't have the resources, and in Alice Springs, there's a lot of families who don't have the resource or the historical models of care themselves to pass on naturally to their families. And that needs to be addressed by more early intervention services. And I'm quite passionate about that.
And this principle about kids deserving the best, that's obviously something that's really at the heart of behind the work that you're doing. Can you pinpoint a time when you thought, yeah, this is the work I want to be doing, I want to be working with kids? Was there a point in time in your life when you knew that that was the direction you'd be taking?
Not necessarily. Probably a hard question to answer. I always wanted more kids of my own. I always felt that if I had unlimited financial resources, I'd always have more kids in the house. So those are things that have been with me for a long time. I think the reality is that the joy that you see on these little hurt children's faces as your relationship builds and the willingness to connect with someone who's safe, it just says to me, every one of these children is worth it, and they're worth more than they're getting at the moment.
What do you think are the values and beliefs that are important to you that are behind the work that you're doing with children?
Social justice is pretty high up on the list in terms of the marginalisation of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and in Australia and in New Zealand is a product of our white culture. And there's no other way we can look at that. And we made our culture better than, in our view, and we didn't include other ways of thinking and feeling about culture. And I mean, I had a conversation this afternoon with a colleague about one family we reunified. And the conversation was that he was talking about, well, you know, the kids in care, well, they get to sit at a table and they get beds. And I said, yeah, but when we reunify them, what happens? Are we setting them up to expect it to be like our world? Or are we setting it up in a way that they can include both worlds? And I still question that. And I have an example, two children we reunified. We went into the house as the workers, and there was, this is the care house, and there was four mattresses on the floor and a big TV and a sloppy couch. And we berated the carers and territory families for not having adequate furniture. And this is in our early days. Okay. And then when it comes the time for these kids to having, and mum having done her work to go back home, it's like, well, mum doesn't have a table, and actually mum doesn't have beds. And so you have a conversation with the carer, and the carer's partner got some four by twos and made some beds. And so that's something that they thought they could do and would do, but the table wasn't that important. And I'm okay with that, because it's the table and it is my culture and doesn't have to be anyone else's.
So what are the implications of that then? We're setting kids up to be in a home where everything is laid out for them, like it would be in a white culture?
Yeah.
What are the implications of that when they are being reunified and going home to where maybe not everything is laid out for them?
Well, it's another traumatized experience quite often. You know, say if I've been in care for 5 to 8 years and living in, say, a foster carer's home who is European or Pākehā white, and I go to live in community where I don't have internet. I'll be lucky if there's a computer there. The way of entertainment is for us to kids to get in groups and go out in the bush and you know, run and play. Whereas my experience has been after school to get some food and go and sit on the PlayStation. All those things are a horrific bridge for children. And it's like, you know, moving into a foreign world. And they often treasure the relationships that they're going back into, particularly in kinship care, and if they're going back into their parents' care, they treasure the relationships. But they challenge the relationships because, the white privilege that they had elsewhere hasn't come with them. And that's horrible, actually.
So you said that social justice is an important value driving your work. What do these considerations around white privilege, how do they play out in other ways in how you go about doing the work in a culturally safe way?
Well, one of the things I introduced in the team was a weekly discussion on what is it we're doing this week that's culturally appropriate that we're trying to build. Okay, so that's one of the measures that I brought to the team. I think part of that's the gift of my wife being Maori. And I remember when we were dating, we went into a bank and she went to one counter and she's a bit black and I'm a bit white and I went to the other counter. And the way in which they spoke to her as the way in which they spoke to me was totally different. And, you know, it for me, it was like the intent of the bank teller may not have been conscious, but the unconscious shaming of her and her seeing it as nothing, this is how the world is. And for me, that was a huge learning in terms of I only know the world from through my eyes, and I've got to look through other people's eyes to see the world as it might be. It's not that I have to live anyone else's way, but everyone else has to find a way that's safe for them to live and be empowered to do so. And I think the marginalisation of Indigenous people has taken the personal power and the potential away and the ongoing traumatisation of Indigenous peoples.
What I'm hearing is that social justice is one of the values that you really hold dearly in your practice. And I'm wondering, are there any particular people or experiences that have influenced this particular value of social justice or any other values, I guess, that you're holding in your work with children and young people?
I think so. And I think it's also some of the choices I made in terms of the life journey. If I look at my mentors, I mean, one of my mentors was a teacher. Because I experienced some trauma as a child and tended to dissociate a lot as in class, I wasn't very academic. And I had two teachers, Andan, a man who was quite young at 26 when I was sort of 14. And both of them were very mild in their responses. So they had really good control of their own process, so people didn't trigger them. And they're both very deliberate and fair-minded. So I always felt I had a fair process with them. And I think that was, for both of those people, the fact that fair process came through quite strong. And then I think in terms of one job I had in my early years was a training officer for an airline. I really enjoyed it. And I was training in ticketing, aircraft weight imbalance, and customer relations. And I'd had no training experience and I hadn't studied any of those things particularly. And the study of customer relations I found incredibly valuable. And I got a program from Delta Airlines in the States, which was their customer service program. It gave me my first sights into, if you like, the psychological makeup of people. And I think the other thing was that when I chose to come into counselling, I'd been facilitating programs for a period of time. And I couldn't find anything, and when I was exploring counselling trainings, I could find lots of things that had a lot of pathology in them, but not a lot about potential and mystery. And so I chose to train in psychosynthesis, which is psycho-spiritual psychology. And for me, it had the balance of, yes, there's pathology, but there's also what is emerging. And I think, you know, in my counselling work, the what is emerging is we're all emerging into accepting that we are worthy and valuable. And, you know, if a client says, how long is this process going to take? You know, a normal adult counselling client, I've always said to them, when you acknowledge your own value and worth, you won't need to come here. And so I'm still blessed by doing 4 or 5 adult sessions a week with a less traumatized population, and what we found in the Holding Children Together program is that for any of our staff to work more than 5 days in this, or to do 5 days a week, has a limit on their ability to manage the level of trauma they're working with. So effectively what we did is that we put in place a process where you could only work 3 days in the children's program and 2 days in other work after your first 12 to 18 months. And when a new person comes on, they often go into the children's program as a full-time worker on the understanding that we'll keep reviewing that, and at some point they're expected to move into doing other work in other programs. And that may be general counselling or EAP counselling or doing some group work.
Just in finishing up, what does the future hold for you? Where do you see yourself going over the next little while?
I think we can achieve evidence-based status in the next probably 6 months with this program.
Fantastic.
We came to Alice Springs for 2 years as part of doing some travel, and we're still here. And that's what's going on 7 years. So, you know, we're not getting younger, and family has a pull that we both acknowledge and allow to pull us a few times a year. But I'm not ready to stop this sort of work yet.
And so what would it mean for the community of Alice Springs for Holding Children Together to achieve evidence-based status? What will that mean for the community there, and how will that filter out to perhaps other communities?
Well, most of the community organisation funding finishes in 2019, and the constant push towards evidence-based means that you're probably going to have it in order to get ongoing funding. The program, when I came into it, had 2 half-time counsellors. At the moment, we've got the equivalent of 4.5 full-time counsellors. And we probably, in discussions with other funders, we can probably see that commitment going up to about 5 counsellors next year. And evidence base will make it substantive, I think. And I think the other thing is the evidence base process is always worth doing, because in it you understand your program more and you make change because the evidence says you have to. And we can talk all you like about evidence base, you know. But the reality is, and as you do the work, it's worth doing, because you end up with a better program. You know, when I came into the CTT in 2011, I couldn't visualise the program as is now. But it makes every bit of sense to me now that it's changed that much.
And so what is the potential for it being adopted into other Aboriginal communities?
In a sense, get evidence-based, you've got to have a portable program. And I suppose RA's adopted some of that in terms of HCT's now the flagship that underpins or overpins all our children's services. There's lots of other bits of programs that work in with it, but in a sense it's the trauma-informed practice, the assessment and therapeutic planning that's been picked up as across RA and the Territory.
And so what areas is that being practiced in now?
TV Islands, Palmerston, Darwin, Catherine. So that in itself says something about Relationship Australia's picking something up in 2011 and growing it. It says something about everyone that's worked in it. It says something about the Australian Childhood Foundation support in the program, particularly in the early days. I mean, in the first 4 years of the program, they put something like 700 people in Alice Springs through the neurobiology of trauma. Now, that's a huge commitment that they did in partnership with HCT, effectively. And it gave us a great gift in terms of more people being trauma-informed. The reality is you've got to keep doing the work to retain the trauma-informed approach, because I think by nature we tend to see the shadow rather than the light.
That must be hugely satisfying to know that all the work that you've been putting in down in Alice Springs is starting to spread out more in the top end now.
Yeah, and as a team, you know, because we are a team here, we've talked about what else we can do with it. We've had approaches from organisations on the coast in terms of exploring it as the program that they might introduce.
Excellent. So just in wrapping up, if people would like to follow up with you personally or they would like to know more about the project, where could they do that? How could they get in contact with you?
So email is probably the best. And my work email is just doug@ra-nt.org.au. I'm happy to share about other people's successes, any suggestions others have, and I'm happy to share my own bits of experience and those that have come out of my staff.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate you taking an hour of your time today to talk to me and to give us an idea about the kind of work you're doing down there at Alice Springs, what you've come from New Zealand, how you've adapted your practice to suit what is a totally different community here in Australia, working with Aboriginal folk down there. So thank you so much again.
You're welcome, Lucy.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.